Coming up on this episode of Nintendo Cartridge Society, we sure hope no one judges us by our first episode. It's dangerous to go alone, so the Nintendo Cartridge Society goes with you. Welcome to Nintendo Cartridge Society. My name is Patrick Ellers, and I'm joined, as I'm always joined, by my co-host, Mark Mitchell. Mark, how's it going?
It's going great. Last week when I was traveling, look, they say that beauty is pain. And this is a...
They do?
And this is a...
Who says this? And this I know no pain, no gain. I know beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
And the third in that trilogy is Beauty and the pain.
Beast. Oh. Okay, beauty is pain. So tell me what was painful but beautiful to you.
So my lips got sunburned. I was really good about applying sunscreen everywhere.
Right.
But I forgot the lips.
Mark was in Florida.
I was in Florida.
We've both spent separate weeks in Florida this year, and then on Tuesday complained about having to maybe go to Florida to go to Universal Orlando.
Maybe Florida is the destiny of this show. I don't know what that means.
I don't like it at all.
My lips were sunburned. So that's the pain part of it.
Yes.
But the beauty part of it is that they were the most beautiful color of red. I looked stunning.
Uh-huh. It's all gone now?
It's all gone. I've been applying chapstick like a madman.
Right.
And so now it's just back to its normal amount. But I feel like it was, you know, the equivalent of my lips walking in stiletto heels. Like painful.
Oh, I see. But you were a knockout.
I was a knockout for those few days where it was happening.
Mark, this is good and this is important, but I
thank you for acknowledging that both those things are true.
Here's something I need to say.
Okay.
So this is something, Mark, that I need to get off my chest.
Yeah, please.
On Tuesday's episode, I, in a moment of weakness and vulnerability, begged for your permission not to buy Endless Ocean Luminous.
Oh, I remember
for
this.
The Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
And you kind of like talked me through it, eventually got to a compromise where we would go halfsies on a copy of the game. So I did not like actually veer from the pact that I had struck to buy everything that Nintendo put out this year. I sure was asking for your permission to do so. I recognize that this is a violation of the pact I have with you, with myself, with the audience. And I apologize for any discomfort that this brought to you, the listener, to you, Mark. I have ordered a copy of Endless Ocean Luminous. I'm picking it up from Best Buy on Saturday.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I feel like we came to a good solution. I don't feel like you should feel bad. I feel like that's what this show is for.
Right.
Us to work through our problems on mic together.
Yes, yes. Yes, I agree. However, I know that you and the audience look to me for strength. For resolution. And in that moment, I was not demonstrating that.
Look, it's true. You're the dad of the podcast. I'm not. And I'm like the quirky, like son who wears his hat backwards. Yeah. And it's just like almost too cool for
his
good. I've
always thought of you as too cool for your own good. Yes. But you really talked me off a ledge there. So, and I just...
It was a very special episode.
It was a very special episode. And I want you and the audience to know that I appreciate it. And I'm glad that I am not straying from my solemn vow
to spend as much money on Nintendo as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not even, because there are things that I didn't buy last year that I could have gone like back to get, but I'm not doing that.
Right.
So there, you know, it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Good.
That's been addressed.
Yeah.
I'm glad. It was hanging over me the last 2 days, and I just had to get it out. If you would like to support us as we get things out, you can go to patreon.com/Nintendo Cartridge Society, where if you are supporting us at the 8-bit or 16-bit levels, you can get access to our once-a-month episodes of miniseries. We are currently making our way through the miniseries called NCS Arcade,
in which Patrick and I are playing games on Nintendo Switch Online and Nintendo Switch Online Plus Expansion Pack that we've never beaten. And for April,
we know,
which we're recording this weekend.
That's right.
But it's our April episode is Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for the Sega Genesis, which I'm really excited to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And if you have any thoughts about Sonic the Hedgehog 2, please email us at NintendoCartridgeSociety@gmail.com so we can incorporate your questions, your comments, your observations, whatever you have to say about Sonic the Hedgehog into the episode. Get those to us by Saturday morning, I guess.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The latest, yeah. Also, you can use that email to get into our Discord, where people are talking about Nintendo stuff all the time. Lots of good conversation going on in there recently regarding the Nintendo World Championships NES edition, what's going on at Microsoft and Xbox. So hop on in there if you want to continue those conversations. Mark, of course, I've got a book in comic book stores right now if you're interested in IDW's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as they head into the relaunch this summer with a new number one with a new creative team. I wrote the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles source book for the 150 issues previous to this relaunch. So it's a quick, easy way to catch up. I'm very proud of it. It's good. You can check it out in stores. Volume 3 of 4 comes out in June. And 1 and 2 are on shelves right now. All right, Mark, let's get into our main topic here. Let's rate some first entries in Nintendo franchises. Okay, so what we've done here, because, you know, we like it when there's like a little bit of a... we don't script these things, mm-hmm. right? We like to be a little bit spontaneous. And so what we've done is we've taken our master list of Nintendo franchises, whittled it down to just those that are like truly franchises with multiple entries that we can talk about. And we are going to randomly select one of them, and we are going to identify the first game in a franchise and talk about it.
Yep. And then in talking about it, we're going to discuss the game itself, and then we're going to reflect on how well we think it represents the franchise as a whole, what the franchise became.
Yeah. Well, and Mark, you came in with this pitch, which is not to throw you under the bus or anything if this is a disaster. I don't think it's going to be a disaster. I'm very excited to do this. But you came in with this pitch, and I was just wondering if there was like an impetus or like some sort of like what made you want to talk about first entries?
Yeah, I feel like we have been... I've at least have been in this mood for since the beginning of the year, where we were getting our feel for what Nintendo's 2024 was going to be.
Yes.
And what it felt like was the end of something.
Yes.
And whenever you're reaching the end of something, the end of the Switch generation, I'm always tempted to kind of like look back.
Right.
And so, yeah, I thought it would be fun to, I mean, there have been so many great entries in Nintendo franchises during the Switch era, that it would be fun to kind of like look back at the beginning and right. see how far we've come, baby.
Yeah, well, and you know, we just did this the exercise with the Metroid series, where we sorted them into, you know, like essentials, greatest hits, next steps, all that kind of stuff. And that always makes me reflect on like how in some instances the first entries in franchises are like must play, like very interesting entries in the franchise. At other times it's like, hey, they didn't crack it yet.
Yeah.
Which Metroid I feel like is a pretty good example of that, of like they didn't crack it yet. Like it's not, it can see that it has the same shape as what the series would end up becoming, but it just isn't itself yet. So what we're doing here is sort of just that with the first entries in various franchises. We have 31 Nintendo franchises on our list. Some of them are a bit more esoteric than others. But I think we should probably just jump into it and do our first random number generator between 1 and 31.
Okay, the first number is number 20.
Number 20, which is Excitebike.
Okay.
So we're starting off with what I would say is one of the more esoteric series in Nintendo's lineup. Skips the Super Nintendo entirely, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get like the NES, and like Excitebike on NES gets repackaged as like the Excitebike Versus as well, like in our arcade machines. But then there's Excitebike 64, there's Excite Truck, and stuff like that. Mark, how familiar are you with Excitebike as a franchise, and how familiar are you with it as a like the NES game?
Yeah, so I feel like I played, well, are we counting like the Wii Excite Truck?
Yeah, I think
games
so.
Is like part of the series. So
I would think so.
Then
yeah.
I would say my familiarity is mostly with the first game and yeah. then the last game.
Sure,
like the Wii one.
Did you not mess around with Excitebike 64 when it came to the Nintendo Switch Online?
No, I haven't.
It's tough to play.
That sounds right for yeah. most Nintendo 64 games.
Yeah, especially games like trying to like I feel the same way about like 1080 snowboarding and to a lesser extent Wave Race, just because I have like nostalgia for Wave Race. But like they're all kind of tough to revisit. But the original Excitebike was always a little bit of a like mystery to me growing up. We never had the cart. My friend Hannah had a copy of Excitebike, and I remember playing it at her house. And then it's always like one of the first ones that I go to when there's like a collection. Like I want to play just a little bit of it, play the first couple races until I can't, you know, finish in like qualifying position, right away, and then quit. But man, Excitebike has some great music. And just like there's a track editor in the original Excitebike. You can make your own tracks.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the one of those things that the NES versions of a lot of those Famicom games, like where Famicom could take advantage of some of the Famicom disc system, or maybe not the disc system, but the Famicom accessories that we
yeah,
didn't
totally.
Get here. Like you could save onto basically a tape deck for some games, you know, with the Famicom, and the NES never got any of that. I feel like the most of my playtime with Excitebike has come from like other variations of it. So it's showing up in WarioWare micro games.
Totally.
Or,
yes.
you know, like pieces of it elsewhere and less with the like the NES game itself, because like you, I never owned it.
Right.
It wasn't like a franchise that meant a lot to me. I remember my cousin having it, so I remember, you know, playing it there. But
and of course Mario Kart 8 Deluxe has the track.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember the Excitebike music because like I just couldn't like picture it in my head, but it's that it's really good.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's really good and it's really catchy. It always bugs me that like there aren't more of these games, and that when they moved to 64, they were like, at least have to be like realistically proportioned guys. When like the NES sprites, of course, look like cartoon characters, they've got these big O heads. And like, I don't know, I feel like that should just have remained the aesthetic.
Yeah. And like the last entry, I think there's a WiiWare game that I never played, but like the last like full release was Excitebots Trick Racing, which was a Wii game. And kind of like a sequel to Excite Truck.
Truck, yes.
But I think you're right. Like, I feel like there's something so specific to the original Excitebike that gets lost. Like, by the time you get to... Like, I thought Excite Trucks was fun for what it is. And Excitebots Trick Racing is also fun. Like, the Trick Racing game kind of reminds me of Stunt Race FX. A little bit in its design.
You got I love some... that we can count on you to bring up Stunt Race FX.
Just in like they give some of the like vehicles kind of googly eyes.
Sure.
Which makes me except their headlights, but it just makes me think of the
cars.
Of the cars.
Cars 2. Cars 3.
No, the cars in Stunt Race FX, which is like anthropomorphized. But I feel like the as the series goes on, it becomes more like more or less generic racing.
Right.
And less like this motocross, you know, physics are a little are like specific.
Yeah.
You know, it loses its identity, I think.
Yeah, and it is very weird, like going from the 2D physics, where like it's important how you are, how the bike is like tilted when you go off jumps, when you land jumps, and like translating that to 3D in Excitebike 64, just feels like it's too like complicated. It's like trying to land a trick again in like 1080 snowboarding, where I'm just like, I don't get how to do this. Let's try to evaluate how Excitebike is as a game, and then also how well it represents the rest of the franchise. I like the original Excitebike okay. Are we rating these on a scale of 1 to 5?
Yeah, let's rate them on a scale of 1 to 5.
And let's determine what the units are going to be.
Okay. Patreon rules.
Yeah, the Patreon rules where we had to come up with the unit 1 out of 5 blank. What is it? So for Excitebike, it'll be 1 out of 5 oil
Stunt
slicks.
Stunt Race FXs? Oh, yeah, that probably
will
makes
not
more
be Stunt Race
yeah,
FXs.
No, no, no. Yours makes more sense. I think oil slicks is good. 1 to 5 oil slicks.
Right. So how good is the game itself? I'm going to say maybe 2 oil slicks.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I haven't played enough of it to really draw a strong conclusion, but what I have played of it, I feel like 2 oil slicks is a good rating. I'll go with 2 oil slicks as well.
Okay, great. And then how well does it represent the rest of the series?
I don't really feel like it does.
It's tough because I think what you and I are both saying is that like the series doesn't have much of an identity.
Yeah.
And like I guess you could also say that like the original doesn't have much of an identity. So does it in that way do a very good job of representing the rest of the series?
Yeah, is it 5 oil slicks?
It might be a perfect score of 5 oil slicks.
Yeah, okay.
All right, great. So Excitebike as its own game gets 2 out of 5 oil slicks as a representative of the rest of the series, which we're stating has no identity. It gets 5 out of 5 oil slicks.
How about in the Patreon, we each give it a rating, then we, you know, like average it all out. But
I'd say
but how about
agree.
For this? Yeah, yes. I think that's what we should do is we'll just have one rating, NCS yes. rating.
That's right. We must reach a consensus.
Yes.
Now between 1 and 30, I got a random number generator up here ready
okay.
to go. And the number is 3.
Paper Mario.
Paper Mario. So we split up the Mario RPGs here, and so Paper Mario is going to be its own entry. The original Paper Mario, of course, a Nintendo 64 game, sort of a sequel to Super Mario RPG. In fact, was originally working title was Super Mario RPG 2 or, you know, whatever. But is decidedly its own franchise.
Well, and what is really interesting about Paper Mario, like trying to use the original game to talk about the entire series, is that there's 2 games that like set the standard for what a lot of people want out of Paper Mario, and then the franchise starts going in different directions.
Right.
And so it's not that the series doesn't have an identity. It's that
it seemingly has an identity that it hasn't fully embraced since the GameCube days. But like it's been like little diversions off that main identity, and seldom like building off of any of those diversions in a single direction, right? Like what's different about Super Paper Mario is not the same as what's different about like Color Splash, right? That like these divergent paths are not like amplifications of each other. They are separate branching paths from this Paper Mario / Thousand Year Door template.
So yeah, totally. But I do think that one thing that has stayed constant with the Paper Mario series that is very present in the first game, I guess there's a few things. One is like that art style.
Yep.
Right? Like everything being paper, Or not everything, but like the cake characters being paper, everything kind of having a crafted look to it.
Right, in like a 2D presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The writing. The first game is really funny and clever, and you know, the characters I don't really know how to express it, speak in unique jargon. Like, everybody has a different voice.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's become a hallmark of the series, that you can always count on it for its sense of humor and its cleverness.
Which is also kind of like that carries over to the Mario and Luigi RPGs as well, right? That like the writing is and like the sort of like funny, irreverent nature of it, like that's present in those as well.
And then the first game, another thing the first game has and the second game has is companions. As you're going through your adventure, you build this party of characters that all have their own like abilities and their own personalities, and then you pick one to be with you, you know, for a certain amount of time, and you can swap out when you want to use their different abilities and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and in these first two games, like, those different abilities are both, like, combat-based and sort of traversal-based, too, so that, like, while you are not in combat scenarios, you are still using their specific abilities to navigate the world that you're in, and, like, back to in combat, that there's, like, a specific way in which their attacks are executed or augmented. Like, some of them you have to like hold the thumbstick in a direction for a little bit, and some it's like a timed button press, or you got to push it a bunch of times, or, you know, whatever. And that those are specific to the character.
Yeah. And I would say that those like action moments within the turn-based combat is another hallmark of the series.
Yeah. And again, kind of a hallmark of the Mario and Luigi series too.
So I really like the first Paper Mario game. The last time I played it was when it was first available on Nintendo Switch Online, I think.
Yep.
So the winter of 2021.
Your discontent. Yes.
That's right. I think it was the winter of 2021. And I really liked it a lot. The game does have shortcomings. There's a lot of backtracking. But overall, I had a really good time with it. And so as far as how good of a game it is on its own, I would give it... Oh, first of all, I guess we need to decide what the rating is going to be.
I have a pitch, but I feel like I got the last one, so...
Oh, how
if
about...
If you want to take it seriously, that is.
Oh, okay, you...
Unless you're just going to suggest Stunt Race FX.
Yeah, you cut out... Yeah, that's actually exactly what I was going to... suggest. I was gonna say badge points.
Badge points is. I was actually just gonna say badges, but badge points is even better.
And it's another thing that is in mm-hmm. both of the first two games,
and maybe in Color Splash at least.
I haven't played Color Splash, so I don't know. And I did play Origami King, but I don't remember like badges being a part of that, and badge points being a part of that. There's probably an equivalent, but basically badge points in the first two games are how you can equip special abilities.
Right.
So you find these different badges or different badges are given to you. You have a limited number of badge points. And when you level up, you can choose to add more badge points, or you can choose to add more like flower points, which are essentially magic, or health points. And so you are limited in how many badges you're able to wear at one time.
And the badges grant you unique abilities or like stat boosts or whatever.
Yeah. So badges are like a cool part of it. So yeah, badge points.
Badges are cool.
Badges are cool.
I want to give this... Is it weird to give it 5? Like, I feel like the original Paper Mario is imminently playable, super fun, and like as a like slight fun, funny RPG. Like, I think it's about as good as a first entry in a franchise can be.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because we're not saying that it's like a perfect game.
No.
But I think how good of a game is it?
It's
on
only a 5-point scale, I mean, right? Like,
yeah, I think it's 5 badge points. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, and then how well is it representative of the rest of the series? This is where it gets tougher, because I do think that there are some ways that it is representative for the reason I expressed before, that like, after Thousand Year Door, everything is a variation on the original Paper Mario.
It's like all of the hallmarks of what makes a Paper Mario game. Well, I guess that's evolved. That's the thing. It's like when Super Paper Mario came out.
Right.
And it was like so different from the first two. You had to, it started changing what it meant to be a super Paper Mario game.
Right.
Because you still had the art style, you still had the clever writing, you know, but
the turn-based combat is gone.
Yeah, like the combat changes, like the traversal changes and like all that kind of stuff. And so it's like, yeah, like the core of what I would consider a Paper Mario game, which is again like that writing, that sort of stuff, is present in all of them. So I do think it's a fairly good representation, except like the gameplay itself, which has changed radically.
Well, and the thing is like if Origami King and Color Splash were doing what they do, but were just like, if it just turned out that like, oh, these battle systems are very fun, because that's really like the big difference, right? Right. There's also like the sort of nuance of how like other characters are treated.
That's a good point. And I do think we should touch on that just real quick.
Yeah.
Because like the first two games especially, they go wild with character design as far as like the Mario world exists. Like there's old Toads, there's young Toads, there's Toads with different,
there's an old priest and a young priest, and they need to
they
work
walk
together
into a bar.
I was doing The Exorcist. but yes, so like there's an individual Koopa who has qualities that make him unique from the rest of the Koopas in the world, and he is his own character.
And they'll have like beards, or they will be wearing an eye patch. And in the later Paper Mario games, they got away from that. There are still Toads, but the Toads all look the same,
right?
But they have different personalities. I don't know. I totally agree with your point.
Oh, sorry. The point that I was driving at is like if the combat mechanics in Origami King function the exact same way, but were just insanely fun, I don't think we would have any complaints about them being different, right? We would just be like, oh, this is a fun take on the Paper Mario formula.
Yeah, and yeah, that's true. I didn't dislike I didn't hate.
High praise from Mark Mitchell. Revising from I didn't dislike to I didn't hate the combat.
I didn't hate the combat. Like I really didn't dislike it. But what I was going to say, just adding on to what you're saying, is, you know, when I think about it, Origami King for 75% of it is really similar to those first two games.
Sure.
The difference is the combat system. That's really like and that's a big chunk of what makes a game the game.
Yep.
But that is the only thing that's different. I'm leaning towards giving this a 3.
I was also going to say 3. Okay. So we're going 3 badge points for Paper Mario as to how well it represents the rest of the series.
All right. 1 through 29. I have it up.
Okay.
Our next one is number 6.
Number 6 is Kirby. I'm expecting some low scores here. So the first Kirby is just Kirby's Dream Land, right?
Yep.
On the Game Boy. Man, I remember the box art for this thing having Kirby as a big white.
White as a ghost.
White as a ghost.
Yeah. Got a real Casper thing going on.
He's got a real Casper thing going on. He cannot absorb people's powers.
Which is so crazy.
It's just like, that's a foundational Kirby-ism. Like, if you were to make a Kirby game now where he couldn't get any powers from the enemies, people would laugh you out of the room.
And that didn't come until the Nintendo game?
I know it's in Dream Land 2.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like, they rectify it pretty quickly. But yeah, it is you know, a lot of like the enemies are present in the original Kirby's Dream Land. I don't know. I think both not a great game and not a great like representative of the rest of the series.
Well, it's weird because I didn't own the original Dream Land, but this is another one that my cousin, it did have, and I remember being at his house for like Thanksgiving or the 4th of July and playing Kirby's Dream Land. So Kirby Dream Land was released in 1992, and then Adventure was released in 93. And Adventure is...
That's the NES one.
That's the NES one, and that's what introduces the ability to like...
So Dream Land 2 comes out after...
Dream Land 2 comes out in 95.
Oh, okay. Wow, okay.
And the... I, at this point, had played Adventure, and so going back to Dream Land and not being able to absorb characters or absorb powers was super crazy. But a lot of the other stuff that we associate with Kirby there. Aesthetics. I want to say, like, the aesthetics of 2D Kirby.
Yeah.
And even, like, the...
And even 3D Kirby. Like, that Willow boss character at the end of the first level is present in that game.
Yeah, and it's so... Yeah, yeah. And it is just, like, a huge part of Kirby. So, is the game on its own... I would give a fairly low score.
No sub-games in the original Kirby.
I think you're right. I think that also was introduced in Kirby's Adventure, where they introduced like the crane game and stuff like that.
Right, and like Quick Draw, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, crazy. So I don't know. It's tough because like in evaluating the quality of just about any Kirby game, I'm like the ceiling is a 3. I don't love this game. I think it's probably better than Excitebike as a game, but like I don't know, 2 probably feels right to me on this.
Okay, so for Kirby, what'll be the scale that we do this on?
Maximum tomatoes?
Yes. Yep, perfect.
Okay. So on a scale of 1 to 5 maximum tomatoes, how good is the original game? I want to say 2.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with the 2 there. And then how representative of the series is it?
In some ways very, but in the one like crucial way not at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to say 2.
Oh, see, I was gonna say 3 or 4, so I feel like we should land on 3 then.
Okay.
It's just the music's there, the like the sort of like constantly on screen UI of like your health being on like the bottom of the screen, that's always there. The items are all the same, the enemies are all there, the bosses, King Dedede, like all of it. It's all there. You just can't absorb powers.
I agree that it is just one thing,
but it is such
missing,
a big thing.
But it's such a big thing.
It'd be like if you couldn't jump in the first Mario game,
right? Like, but I think 3 is fair. I'm not gonna argue that. Is King Dedede in the?
I don't know. I said
the GameCube
it.
One? I said or not it. The GameCube one. Oh boy. let's just move on.
All right, great. All right, now between 1 and 29, I am 28. I am generating number 6.
Pikmin. Okay.
5 and 5.
this is a real blind spot for me. So,
yeah, recently not a blind spot for me. So the Pikmin obviously as a series starts on GameCube with just OG Pikmin and it is a sort of real-time strategy game that's really more about like resource management and exploration. There are 4 entries, 4 main entries in the franchise, most recently with Pikmin 4, which outside of Zelda was my favorite game of last year. It totally Pikmin pilled me, made me go back and play Pikmin's 1 and 2. And I got to get around to playing 3 as well. But so I very recently loved this series. I obviously loved Pikmin 4, but the thing that sort of like sealed the deal for me was going back to Pikmin 1 and experiencing what felt like a classic, what felt like a stroke of genius and like a special object in Nintendo's history. It is so well calibrated to like you have a certain number of days to explore these 4 or 5 different areas discover new Pikmin that will help you gather parts for your ship to repair it. And if at the end of that time you have not collected the necessary pieces, it's game over. You could have played like 10 hours of this game and just not be able to do it. It's it's imminently doable, right? Like, on my first try, I beat it with like 2 or 3 days to spare. Then there's like a leaderboard that pops up at the end to be like, here's like, it records all of your attempts. So it really encourages like replaying, and it's so open and free that you can approach it in so many different ways. The original Pikmin is like elemental in that there are only three different kinds of Pikmin: yellow, red, and blue, and they have very simple qualities. The yellow ones can be thrown far. The red ones can endure heat and attack a little bit harder. The blue ones can go in water. And like, that's sort of it. Everything is so simple, and the pieces are there, and just like so manageable. And it's a blast. I love Pikmin 1.
The two things that I think about when I think of Pikmin 1 is how different Pikmin looks from any other Nintendo franchise.
Yeah.
Like, it's intentionally ugly in a really hilarious way.
Yeah, in almost a rare kind of way. Almost, right?
Right. Like, Rare the developer.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. The two-legged, like, I was going to call them a Bulbasaurs, but that's obviously not right.
Yeah, they're like Bulborb or something like that. Yeah.
Like, they it looks like no other Nintendo franchise.
Yeah.
The second thing is that the, and please correct me where I'm getting this wrong, is that they kind of, in some ways, Dead Rising'd the second game and like the third game, where they started to soften what like the time limit meant and how like the time limit was implemented, right?
So not really. So the there's always a different crunch on you in Pikmin. And in the first one, it is a time thing. You have a certain number of days in which to accomplish your goal. In the second game, there is no time limit, but it is much more demanding of your physical resources. You can get yourself into a situation in Pikmin 2 where you have lost all of your Pikmin, and like building them back up would be impossible because you no longer have like the resources you started with to like do it. So like, you can get yourself into a corner there. In Pikmin 3, the limiting resource is juice, which you gather as like, instead of ship parts or whatever, you gather fruits to get food for the next day. And like, it's pretty tough to run out of that. So like, you kind of functionally have an unlimited number of days. And then in Pikmin 4, again, you do have an unlimited number of days, but the limitations are, I mean, Pikmin 4 is just like multifaceted and is sort of like a genius implementation of all three limitations at once. Like, to answer your question, like, yes and no, they messed with the sort of compelling limiting factor of the first game, but I think Pikmin does a much better job of it than Dead Rising does.
So I really kind of defer to you on this one. Where first of all, Pikmin, I think the worst rating out of 1 to 5, Pikmin.
Yeah, I think so.
And then, so how many Pikmin would you give Pikmin as a game on its own?
I mean, it is a masterpiece game. It's 5. It is special. It is an amazing little relic that like, tell me the special things that Nintendo does, and you'd be like, oh well, Zelda obviously, just as a franchise, the Mario Odyssey and Pikmin. Like, I think it's up there.
Remind me, would you recommend it as the original Pikmin as the starting point for people, or would you?
No, I would say 4. I would say play 4. 4 is so much more accessible and beautiful. The original Pikmin looks good, but it looks like it's a GameCube game, because it is. But yeah, it is incredible. And once you are like tuned to it, you can get through that experience pretty quickly. So.
And then, how many Pikmin out of 5 do you like? How representative of is Pikmin 1 of the series as a whole?
Yeah, I mean this. I think 5. I think what is special about Pikmin 4, you see the DNA of all of that in the original Pikmin. Obviously, the games have grown and changed, and like gotten different. I don't think there are elements I think of them that have like gotten better and gotten worse. But I think it is just like generally such a high bar for the series that I think Pikmin is totally representative of Pikmin.
All right. 1 through 27, and our number is number 15.
Whoa, going deep.
Wario Land.
The Wario Land series. We've not seen an entry in this one since the Wii. And then, so we got to go back to what? The Game Boy? To Super Mario Land 3 Wario Land?
Yeah, I guess so.
Otherwise, we're talking about the Virtual Boy Wario Land, and I don't think we are.
Nope, we're not. Yeah, what a interesting kind of like entry point for Wario to have his own spinoff game.
Yeah.
Where he's introduced in Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins, where he's the villain, and then the third Super Mario Land game is like a backdoor pilot.
Yep.
For a Wario series.
I love the identity that Wario Land, the original Game Boy game, carves out, because it is taking a lot of the same like things that you were doing in Mario Land 2, which is like traveling to different worlds and like collecting treasures and coins and stuff. But it is just like it gets rid of some of the like Mario isms and is like, no, Wario is just like a little bit different, right? He has special hats that give him powers in the first game. This is something that they kind of do away with pretty early in the series. But like he has one hat that's like a bull horns, so that like when he dashes, it like deals, it'll break more stuff. He's got one that's like a dragon and it like breathes fire. And then there's like a rocket one. Is that right?
I think so.
So that he like dashes in the air. Yeah, I don't know. That original Wario Land game is quite good. I like it a lot.
I like it a lot, too. And I feel like this is a series that I wish Nintendo would go back to.
I agree.
Because it is an interesting... It's the original Wario Land is playing with a lot of the same things that Nintendo was at the same time exploring with Mario in some ways, where it's like, okay, Super Mario World... We're slowing Mario down a little bit.
Sure.
You know, like, things are a little more exploration-based. It's not like Super Mario Land, Super Mario Land 2, or, like, the first three Super Mario Brothers games where it's all about how fast can I get through this course.
Yeah.
You know, Wario Land introduces this idea of, yeah, like, Wario's a little heavier. It's not about the joy of movement with Wario. It's more about, like, exploration. Backtracking in levels plays like a bigger part in it.
And all of that is driven by like the character of Wario, like the whole greed component, right? That like he wants to get as much, because the whole game is based on like you're paying a genie to grant you wishes, and the more money you have at the end of the game, the bigger house that you get from wishing from this genie, which by the way, this is a bad genie. Genie should do these things for free. But like, so yeah, like finding all the treasures within the game feels very like motivated, right? Like finding all these secret areas in like a Mario game, you're like doing it just to do it because it's fun to find a secret.
Mm-hmm.
But like Wario is going to actually like benefit from the secret he finds there.
Yeah. So I like the first Wario Land game quite a bit. I've never played the Virtual Boy one.
Mm-hmm.
And then
there's 2 and 3 on Game Boy and Game Boy Color, and then 4 on GBA.
And then Shake It,
right,
the Wii entry, I liked fine. There was something about it, like I love the art style.
Art style,
it's like
fantastic,
hand-drawn
yeah.
animation. There's something about the gameplay itself that didn't click with me for whatever reason.
Man, I love Shake It. I think Shake It is like a banner game. That is one of the that's a game that I was playing with my roommates in Chicago, and we would like meticulously go back in, and like when we missed something in a level, we would go back and like try and do it again and again. And then just a couple years ago, when my buddy Andrew was out here for something, we popped it back in. And like discovered that there was like a level near the end that we hadn't done everything in. And we did it. So like, I don't know. It's a very cool game and I have a lot of fond memories of Shake It.
But I do feel like that's a series that, to my mind, the Wario Land series didn't really change or evolve that much.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, like, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? It's rare for Nintendo.
Right.
Is maybe why we haven't seen a new entry recently, because they don't really love to just like repeat iterate themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there is one thing that the series, I don't really know when it starts doing this. It might be in 3, but maybe it's in 2. But it's not present in the Virtual Boy or the original, where there are no, like, you can't be killed by enemies. Instead, being hit by an enemy just like changes Wario's quality. So like you hit something that's like fire and it'll make Wario like run around like he's on fire, right? Or like he can get smushed and then he's like a little flat guy running around, and you use all of these like damage states to access other areas. That is not present in the original Wario Land, and I do think that is something that's almost like the Kirby caliber, not being able to gain powers.
Is that part of Shake It? I don't remember it being part
maybe
of Shake It.
Maybe that's also not part of Shake It either. I think Shake It, you can like get hit and maybe like lose money or maybe just lose health or something. Yeah, it is just health. But yeah, Shake It, I guess, does away with that. But 2, 3, and 4 are really big on the idea that taking damage from enemies is not a bad thing, but just something that changes Wario's state.
And to use that to find secrets is a fun idea.
It's genius, yeah. It's and you know, the idea that like Wario is effectively invincible, hilarious, right? Let's smash him. Let's turn him into a zombie. Like it's all fun.
So Wario Land,
yeah,
1 out of 5.
Ooh, yes.
Motorcycles.
Does he ride a motorcycle in any of those games? It's really more of a WarioWare
thing. Yeah.
Let's treasures,
wishes.
Let's go treasures.
Okay, cool.
Either treasures or upside down M's. Let's go treasures. On a scale of 1 to 5 treasures.
The game by itself is pretty good. I think I would give it a 3.
I was going to say 3 or 4, so let's go with 3. And then how representative is it of the rest of the series?
I also kind of want to give it a 3. A lot of it is there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's recognizably Wario.
Yeah, totally.
Land all the way through.
Right.
So maybe it's a 4?
Maybe it's 4. I do think the fact that Wario has, like, the different hats as power-ups, because that's something that doesn't come back in... Maybe it's in the Virtual Boy game, but it's definitely not in 2, 3, 4, or Shake It. But yeah, kind of everything else, it's all there. Yeah, we'll say 4 for that. All right, great. So now on a between 1 and 26, I am generating the new number, and the number is 12.
Mario Party.
Oh boy, the original Mario Party. Well, let's talk about Mario Party as a franchise. This is a weird franchise, right?
In what way?
In that it... So I'm going to say that the original Mario Party, not super representative of what the series became. Because the series has been through so many iterations that, like, I don't know, keep trying to, like, capture the same spirit of, like, 4 people sitting around and, like, you know, hurting their hand, the palms of their hands by rotating a stick as fast as they can. And it just never really reaches it again, right? Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I guess what I feel like is, because I was going to say, I feel like it's pretty representative. Well, that's interesting, because I think mechanically it's representative.
This is true.
Of what the series is. But, and maybe you and I have because I don't think either of us love the Mario Party series.
Yeah.
But sales-wise, the Mario Party series continues to be incredibly successful. So I do think people are finding what you're describing in it, which
that's a good point.
You know, like the ability to sit down with your friends and have these fun slash silly slash sometimes infuriating interactions playing these, you know, like quick mini games.
Right. It is worth pointing out, of course, that Super Mario Party on the Switch is the 8th best-selling game on Switch with 20.66 million copies.
And it's like, it's a genius formula. It's, you know, like you put...
This is true.
It's like a Mario-themed mini game collection.
That is also a board game.
That is also a board game. And now, like, Mario-themed mini game collections or, like, Nintendo mini game collections, we see that in a lot of different variations. But I'm trying to think of...
Yeah, where was the home for game, this before that?
Yeah, before Mario Party came along. So I would say... And
maybe
look,
maybe you're right. And I mean, it also kind of like births a format of game, right? That like a board game with a collection of mini games, like they sort of invent that.
So there's a series in Japan that I think is called Fortune Street.
Yes.
And I don't know if it existed before or after the Mario Party series. But the other thing I wanted to say about the first Mario Party is that
we got to get back to Fortune Street.
The other thing I want to say about Mario Party,
yeah,
is that the very first game, I think, had a lot of the same complaints that people have about the series now, which is kind of like the glacial pacing.
That's true.
Of like the board game. You know, like,
it's, like half the mini games are bad.
Like, I think all of that has been present.
Yeah, winning
from
is
the
arbitrary.
Very first game.
Yeah. I mean, it may just come down to the fact that like I don't really like Mario Party in sort of like any format.
I think yeah. Mario Party is a fun idea. Rarely do I, and I think I do have fun playing Mario Party, because some of the mini games
alone in your room all by yourself.
Yeah. Just, yeah. I don't know. It's not a series I think about that much.
Let's you and I fix Mario Party right now. Here's how you fix Mario Party.
Okay.
Okay. Number one. You can opt into like random stars slash like random screwing people over or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like the thing where it awards you, like you landed on the most red squares, you get a power star at the end. You can opt into that or not at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, that's fair.
Second, all dialogue is skippable.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So the two big ones right there. Three, you can toggle off mini games. If there's a mini game that you don't want to play, you can toggle it off. Number four, no unlocking anything. Everything is available from the beginning.
And then five, when you're on the board itself, everything should move three times as fast as it does currently.
Yes, agreed.
And
you can toggle that also back to
yeah,
like, if
sure.
You want to
if you want
slow,
the glacial pace,
that's fine.
That's so funny that I think what you're saying about the like the random stars being awarded.
Mm-hmm.
Is true. That should be an option, but it doesn't bother me.
It doesn't bother me either. Well, and mostly because like as I'm playing Mario Party, I'm so desperate for something interesting to happen that when it does like a dramatic shift, like now this loser is winning.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh,
I know. I also there's like the blue shell quality of it.
Yes,
it's annoying when the blue shell hits you.
Right,
but in all other circumstances, the blue shell is fun.
Right. Yes, I absolutely agree.
I honestly am gonna say that it's first of all, five out of
power stars.
Power stars.
Yeah.
Yep. So I think it's a
for the game itself.
For the game itself, two power stars.
Maybe one.
Maybe one. Or let's give it a one. Let's be honest, true to our hearts.
True to our hearts.
One. But I'm gonna say it's a five.
Sure.
As
sure.
far as how
you've
representative
turned me all the way around, yes.
of the series.
All right. We're gonna do 10 of these total. We've done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We've got four more to go.
Okay.
So now the random number generator between 1 and 25.
It is number 18.
Number 18. Metroid Prime.
Okay, when we did the Metroid Greatest Hits just mm-hmm. a few weeks ago, Metroid Prime was a game that we talked about that is a little difficult to classify because the other two in the series so far don't match the heights of the first game. But I guess all the formula
is there. Yeah, totally. Well, and the problem with Metroid Prime, if there is one, is that the game is too good, right? Like, it's so, with the exception of the sort of backtracking of the artifacts at the end, is just like a perfect expression of what a 3D Metroid, like, exploration first-person shooter should be.
Yeah, I completely agree. It is not a perfect game, but I don't know that you could do 3D Metroid better. They haven't so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, they have not so far.
Because every thing, like, 2 and 3 felt the need to just keep adding stuff.
Yes.
It was just, like, more things, whereas the simplicity of Metroid Prime is part of what makes it
absolutely
perfect.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. And, like, the way that it is effectively just adapting all of the best parts of the 3D Metroid games, or 2D Metroid games that came before it, and just, like, presenting them in 3D for the first time, and it being, like, magical, is basically perfect. Plus, it has the whole scan visor mechanic, whereby, like, you can find out more about the world if you want to, and if you don't, you can just skip it. Doesn't matter.
And for my money, a lot of the other elements of the Metroid Prime series, like the music and everything, again, they kind of knocked it out of the park in the first one.
I agree.
And the other two are...
I mean, the other five, please.
Yeah, you're right. Pinball and Hunters.
And Federation Forces.
They're not... the music is good, but it is not...
It's, like, unremarkable.
It's unremarkable. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. I think we're... Or do, anything else you want to say about it, or should we, are you ready to rate?
I think I'm probably ready to rate it. I do just want to make the observation that with Metroid Prime, this is the third series that we're discussing that started on the GameCube. And for whatever reason, franchises that start on the GameCube are just, like, awesome. Like, right? Because, like, Paper Mario, incredible game. Pikmin, incredible game.
Well, Paper Mario started on the Nintendo 64.
That's a great point. Thank you for you got me, and you're right. And it was a bad observation I was making. No, you're right, Mark. I support you in this.
Metroid Prime.
Yeah,
we're doing it out of Bounty Hunters.
Sure.
Metroids.
Space
Pirates.
Let's go out of Space Pirates. So Metroid Prime on a scale of 1 to 5 Space Pirates.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt you real fast. Beat to say, not that long ago, you and I were having a discussion. In fact, it was probably this Metroid episode. We were having a discussion, like, in what way is Samus a bounty hunter? Like,
right,
have we ever seen
right.
her bounty hunt? And then in the Discord, somebody posted an article talking about how Nintendo, for the longest time,
didn't know what a bounty hunter was.
And so when she was originally labeled a bounty hunter, they just thought it meant, like, space explorer.
Right. Which, you know, like, fine. a Boba Fett-like. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, Metroid Prime, we're rating it on Space Pirates. As a game, I'm going to give it, maybe it is another 5, where it's not perfect. You know, just like
right.
Paper Mario. It almost has the Paper Mario problems. Just
it
too
does.
Much backtracking.
Yeah, that's right.
But we gave Paper Mario a 5. I would give the original
let's
Metroid
give,
Prime
let's
5.
Let's give Metroid Prime 5 out of 5 Space Pirates. How well is it representative of the rest of the series?
I would say it's very well representative in the sense that it's the best one. Like, they knocked it out of the park.
I see what you mean. And, like, the rest of the games are trying to do that, right? They just are not, they don't achieve it as successfully. So... is this a 5-5, just like Pikmin?
Or
is it like
should
a
5-4? Should we look at it the other way, where it's like, it is so good, and the rest of the series doesn't live up to it, and so it's
right.
not really representative of the series, because if you want more of what made the first game so good, it's diminishing returns thereon.
What's tough here is that Metroid Prime starts the series. The most recent entry in the series is Metroid Prime Remastered. I don't know, from beginning to end.
Book
it
ended
seems
by
like
greatness.
Basically.
All right, let's just go with 5.
Let's just go with 5 for that one.
Okay.
Book ended by greatness. Okay, between 1 and 24. Oh, or yes?
1 and 24, yes.
Okay. How did that happen? I did out of 26 last time, didn't I?
I did 25.
You did 25.
Yeah.
There we go. That's the answer. Between 1 and 24, the answer is 24.
Labo.
We're talking Nintendo Labo. Of course, four entries in this franchise: the Variety Pack, the Giant Robot Pack, the Vehicle Pack, and the VR set.
And then arguably Game Builder Garage.
Arguably Game Builder Garage as the hidden fifth entry.
Here's a question for you.
Yep.
Labo released two packs on the same day, the Variety Pack and the Robot Pack.
Yes.
Which one are we counting as the initial entry? Variety Pack?
Variety Pack, yes. Because they are also numbered. So Variety Pack is 001.
Oh, you're right.
Ambitious.
Dreaming big.
Yes. Oh, that we were living in a world where there was 100 of these things. Yeah. Pretty incredible.
Labo is so cool. And it has been so long since... I understand why Labo didn't...
Oh, yeah.
Catch the world on fire. But it is crazy to me that it's been so long, that the Switch generation has been so long, that Labo was like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoyed the time that we spent together building these Labo kits. The making of Labo must have been so fascinating. Like, the amount of prototyping that had to go into it, and then like figuring out how to manufacture it, and they're doing it all with cardboard and rubber bands and like tape that glows in the dark. Just like all of these really simple, very cool things. Labo is so incredibly Nintendo, and I'm so glad that it exists. I think it has been so long that...
I think you have to kind of talk about it in the past tense, right? That, like, Labo is something that existed. This is going to be one of those things like the BS, like, Satellaview games that, like, are simply unplayable. Like, we will reach a point slash have maybe already reached the point where it's like, you won't be able to get your hands on an unmade Labo set.
My guess is that Labo is out of print.
Gotta be.
Like, my guess is you can't, like, from Best Buy order, you know, a new Labo kit that's, you know, or like on Amazon that's not from a third party.
Right. Unlike other things that get sold via third parties, there's no, like, how do you pirate Labo?
Right.
And how do you, like, you play Labo and then resell it? You kind of can't. Like, it is a one and done kind of experience.
So Labo is a... You know, like, it came in a big kit.
Sure, let's explain Labo.
And, you know, you would put the game cart into your Switch, and really it was just instructions. And you could kind of, like, rotate the images and fast forward and rewind to, like, understand how you're supposed to put the pieces together. But then it was basically just like a craft project. It had printed, it had sheets of cardboard that you would punch out the pieces, and then it would ask you to maybe, like, roll them or tape them or put them together in interesting ways, and you would build different things. You would build like a piano or a house that when you hit the plunger, like, it made different noises, like things like that. And it took advantage of the Switch hardware. Like, a lot of times you were putting the Joy-Con inside it, or like the right Joy-Con that has the IR sensor that would be used in various ways.
Right. Yeah. And you know, not to like undersell like the value of the software that goes with it, because like, the vehicle kit you could use then to drive a vehicle around this like open world, and like had all these like you know, checklisty sort of like Ubisoft open world style objectives to accomplish in this vehicle. And like, you could fly it as a plane if you had like the flight stick constructed, or you could drive it as a car if you had the wheel constructed. So like, all of that is fascinating. Mark, you can buy actually a fair I'm on Amazon right now. And you could get the Toy-Con, you know what? It's not 001, it's just 01. But even still, they imagined a world where they were going to make at least
double
10
digits
of these things. And they only made 4. But you can get the variety kit for $80 for like the street price on Amazon.
Oh.
And you can get the like the robot kit for $51. That's below the
are
price.
They like new, unused, or are these like third party sellers that are selling?
Well, I mean, they may be third party sellers, but like they're new in box. Yeah.
Huh. Should we buy this as an investment for our children's future?
Yes.
Labo's gonna be worth something someday, right?
I think so, yes.
If nothing else after the nuclear apocalypse, for building materials.
Right. Well, cardboard will be the only thing that survives the nuclear
apocalypse.
Famously. Right. Okay, so How do we?
Well, I would say that the first game, the variety kit, as a game, as an experience, is a 4.
It's a 4, yeah. I mean, it is, I really don't want to, like, Labo's so strange, I don't want to, like, oversell how good it is, but I also don't want to, like, undersell it as an experience. We need to come up with a unit. Rubber bands. But, like, I don't know. I built Labo sets with my parents. I built Labo sets with Sarah's parents. It is a gaming experience that can transcend, like, generations and tastes and stuff. Like, it's not Wii Sports, obviously, but I had some Wii Sports-like experiences with Labo.
And, you know, if you were going interested in trying it, I would not start with Labo VR. We really did not enjoy our time with Labo VR.
No, but the variety kit and the vehicle kit are both, like, they're both very fun, and I like them a lot.
I feel like the downs... Yeah, I enjoyed my time with putting Labo together immensely. But after you put it together, it's like, you're done. There is software.
You screw around with it for a little bit.
You know, you can use the steering wheel in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe if you really want to.
Yeah, that's right.
But the joy of Labo for me was putting it together. And then once that was done, like,
yeah, it's kind of,
it's hard. It's also hard to repeat that.
Right.
So yeah, I would say 4.
And then you're also kind of left with, like, what do I do with this now? We have like boxes that rest on top of our refrigerator that just houses completed Labo. Because, like, what are you supposed to do with them?
Yeah.
You don't want to throw them away.
I would say, as far as representative of the series, a 5.
Kind of 5, yeah. Like, this came out the kiln fully formed, so. Great. Are you then doing between 1 and 23?
Yes, I am. And that number is number 6.
Number 6.
Pokemon. Well, for better or for worse, I think the series has not, in some ways it's evolved enormously since Red and Blue. But in other ways,
the formula
persists.
And also, like, I know there have been, like, a lot of changes that have made Pokemon, like, more dynamic or more interesting. And obviously, like, people gripe about changes and stuff. But, like, the original Pokemon is a compelling game. It is my favorite Pokemon, which I guess isn't saying that much, as I'm not much of a Pokemon guy. But, like, there's something so approachable and digestible about the original 150 or 151 that it's just like, yeah, Pokemon Red and Blue are, like, they're what I want. I don't want a Pokemon to be more complicated than that.
I feel like in a lot of ways, Pokemon,
we're talking about the Game Boy game, of course,
Pokemon represents what a lot of people want out of Paper Mario, where and it's almost like Paper Mario, take a look at the alternate reality, like Paper Mario fans that just want the Paper Mario games to be
this is a great
Paper
point.
Mario 1 and, like, Thousand Year Door. Take a look at the Pokemon franchise and that fandom wanting it to evolve past that. And yeah, you're right. Like, it's not that the Pokemon games are exactly the same. You know, they continue to introduce different Pokemon for sure, but different gameplay elements into the series, but it hasn't really moved past much of what those original games offered, and the formula wears on people who have been playing for the past 20 years.
Right.
So be careful what you wish for when you just want to see.
Careful, Paper Mario fans. Your franchise too could be the highest earning franchise, entertainment franchise in the world.
Intellectual video game, intellectual property.
Just intellectual property, period, right? Yeah. It is just the most successful thing on the planet.
Pokemon. Anything else we want to say about it?
I think you and I are very well-versed in Pokemon, and the more we talk about it, the more people will realize that we are Pokemon experts.
So, best
Best to get out of this as soon as we can.
Yeah.
So what is this on a scale of 1 to 5 Bulbasaurs?
Bulbasaurs. Yep. And I would say the first game, a 4?
Yeah, I was going to say 3 or 4. But yeah, 4 is perfect. And then how well is it representative of the rest of the series?
I want to say 5.
Yeah, let's go 5. I mean, that feels right to me, which is not necessarily a knock against the franchise, but like there are a lot of ways that it hasn't changed really all that much. All right, what is the next?
The next is 22. Is this our last?
This will be our last one.
Yes. Okay.
So, that was 1,022. Here we go. 22. The game we're going to be discussing is number 17.
Donkey Kong Country.
Donkey Kong Country. Great game. My favorite of the original trilogy.
My favorite of the original two. I'm sure partly because it's the one that I played the most when I was a kid.
And itself being like a bit of a, not a bit of, but like a total reinvention, right? Of the character and like what he can be in a game. No longer the villain, now the main character. It's a side-scrolling, almost in line with the Wario thing that we were talking about before, like an exploration-based platformer game that is still kind of like based in like the joy of movement, right? It's faster and like stringing together, you know, like rolling off the edge of a thing and then jumping when you're in coyote time there.
It also introduced some, I mean, first of all, it was the graphics for its time.
Totally.
You know, that was a huge deal for Nintendo. These pre-rendered sprites that looked like 3D models.
Seems laughable now. Seems like we should be laughing about it.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, that was like, it looked like the future.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe this was happening on the Super Nintendo.
Also introduces a whole new family of Kong characters that persist to this day.
The music is timeless.
Legendary, yep.
And continues to be a big part of it. It's what people think of when they think of Donkey Kong now. I would
totally
say that the arcade game is not top of mind when people think of Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
Also,
is this the first, if we're talking about Donkey Kong Country, this is the first Super NES game that we're talking about on this list?
Yeah,
yes.
I think so.
Yes. Which is interesting because we frequently talk about the Super NES as a place where NES ideas were perfected and like iterated upon in like their ultimate form, and that's just not the case for Donkey Kong Country. It's just something new.
Yeah. How do we think it stacks up with the rest of the franchise? Because we have the two Rare developed games on Super Nintendo,
right?
So Donkey Kong Country 2, Diddy's Conquest, and Donkey Kong Country 3.
Dixie Kong's Double Trouble.
Double Trouble.
Yeah.
And then in the Wii/Wii U/Switch era, we had the reinvention of it. So developed by Retro, the first game on the Wii, Donkey Kong Country Returns, and then Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze on
arguably
the Wii U.
Donkey Kong 64 erasure, but
that's true. But I feel like
Does feel like its own thing.
It does feel like its own thing. It doesn't have country in the title.
True.
It does kind of play with the, I mean, it definitely plays with the idea of like an extended Kong family.
Yeah.
But I personally
and
wouldn't
consider it.
It's got
a K rule at the end of it. I think it's part of the,
okay, let's include it.
I mean, it is also like kind of really part of like the Banjo-Kazooie franchise in, you know, if we're talking about like what the actual gameplay is, like it was when Rare was on that mascot platformer kick.
Yeah.
A collectathon kind of thing. I mean, we consider it like a soft part of the franchise.
Sure.
How about that? Anything else to say about Donkey Kong Country?
I guess I just wanted to talk a little bit about how it fits in with the rest of the games.
Yeah.
Because two, I would say, is the beloved of the retro titles.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tropical Freeze has its fans.
Not just has its fans, but I feel like, especially in the years since its release, has gotten this sort of like second look as like, oh yeah, this thing's legit and is genuinely like a great 2D platformer.
And then Donkey Kong Country Returns
mm-hmm.
was a huge deal when it was announced.
Yeah. Cursed by a weird control scheme.
Yes.
You had to shake the Wii remote to like roll, which is insanity.
But it is interesting that Returns had its own like striking visuals, just in a way, you know, that were very like marketable, a big, like the, especially the levels that were at sunset in silhouette.
Right.
Like that played a big part into the marketing. Maybe not mind blowing in the way that the pre-rendered sprites of Donkey Kong Country were, but they had their own. Sorry, I was interrupting my own thought to remember. The other thing I want to talk about with Donkey Kong Country is it introduced these minecart levels.
Yes, which we got to get back to Fortune Street at some point. minecart. This is a great point. These sort of like roller coastery levels that as they iterate on them, like they are some of the more bombastic fireworks display parts of Tropical Freeze.
And distinctly Donkey Kong Country.
Absolutely, right. That's not something that happens in Mario, for example. Or Sonic or whatever. Like, it's just Donkey Kong Country.
Okay. Bananas? Is that where are we rating the sound of bananas?
Oh, banana. And what was your catchphrase for Mario versus Donkey Kong Month again?
My catchphrase was, not yet, but I'm working on it.
Right. Yeah, very good. So, how many bananas out of five does Donkey Kong Country get?
I want to give it a 5, but I think it's more because in my heart, I love the original Donkey Kong Country so much. Right. But I understand it does have flaws. It is not a perfect game. So I would maybe 4.
I think I also love it, but recognize that 4 is probably more accurate.
But how representative of the series is it?
I mean, seems like very, right? Like, all of these games have the sort of like overworld map where you are like, so you go into a world and there are multiple levels within it.
You have the two different characters with different strengths and weaknesses that you can switch between. It includes the two-player co-op, or like, you know, not really co-op, but
semi-co-op.
Uh-huh.
They're all like known for their challenge. So it sounds like that's 5 out of 5, very representative of the whole series.
Yeah, 5 bananas.
5 out of 5 bananas for how much does Donkey Kong Country represent the rest of the Donkey Kong Country series.
It's kind of crazy looking at our list.
Mm-hmm.
Excitebike is 5. Pikmin is 5. Wario Land is a 4. Mario Party is a 5. Metroid Prime was a 5. Labo was a 5. Pokemon was a 5. Donkey Kong Country was a 5.
What does that mean? Does that mean Nintendo is just very consistent with, you know, like they land on what the brand of a game is and they just iterate on that? But it's a company like famous for not wanting to just iterate on stuff.
But yeah, I feel like it's, look, I mean, there's 2 on here that we don't. Let's talk about Zelda, right? This is one where
you're talking about from our main list here, not what we've actually reviewed.
Yeah. Like if you think about Zelda. Let's put Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom aside for a second.
Put it in a separate little box.
You look at the first game and then compare that to Skyward Sword. And on the one hand, the series has gone through like a radical transformation.
Right. And sort of a linear one too. Right. That like it hit Link to the Past, which turned into a 3D version of itself with Ocarina, and then like just kind of evolved from there.
But on the other hand,
let's go to the other hand.
The core of the series, which is, you know, like you play as Link, you are exploring a Hyrule, you are going to these different dungeons, and
you have a sword.
You have a sword.
You like, probably have a bow and arrow.
Like all of those things are there. Or with Mario, which we also didn't talk about.
Right.
Like in some ways, the series is crazy different. But if you remove all the different accoutrements that they've added to the Mario series,
right,
2D or 3D over the year, the core of that game is the joy of running, the joy of controlling Mario, and that was there from day one.
Right, that's true. That it's like the central verb of the game, run and jump, for Mario is, and for Zelda, it's explore, right? That like all of these, they find the one compelling thing, and they're like, that's the game. We don't make Mario games, we make run and jump games. And I think that's probably true for a lot of these series that have the staying power to be included on our list of Nintendo series.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. All right. Well, Mark, how about we close this out? sometimes the volume gets turned down a little bit between segments. That's going to do it for this episode of the show. If you have any feedback or any difference of opinion, please email us, NintendoCartridgeSociety@gmail.com, or hop in the Discord and let us know. Mark, we haven't talked about our like iTunes reviews or Apple Podcast reviews in a while, but we had one recently that it was a positive review overall, but they said that we did Mario 64 dirty in our greatest hits episode, and I forget where we put it. Not as essential, right? Maybe as next step.
I feel like as next step.
But I feel like you and I did a pretty good job of like justifying that position, did we not?
Hey, but we welcome the difference of
opinion. We welcome the difference of opinion. Or you get in the Discord, which you can
yell at us directly.
You can yell at us directly. Mark and I are in there all the time. We read it when you yell at us there. That's going to do it for this episode. Thank you to our 60-minute patrons, Connor McKay, Patrice Millette, David Henley, Alias X, and Kyle Seaborn. We appreciate you all so very much. We appreciate people giving us criticisms in our Apple Podcast.
As long
reviews.
As it's 5 stars. As long a little as sugar stars. With that salt.
Yeah, that's right. And look, that's all we just care about the stars, baby. Anthony DeLuca made our logo. Our theme music is provided by 8BitBetty. You can get more of his music by going to 8BitBetty.com or by listening right now. For my co-host, Mark Mitchell, this is Patrick Ehlers saying thank you for listening.